Hi, this edition of Rogue Finch Radio, Ashanti and the Black Revolutionary Movement, was originally broadcast on February 28, 1999.
Through the satellite, got lost in the ride up to the plunge down. Man sends the ray of the electric light, sends the impulse through the air down to home. And you can stand on the arms of the Williamsburg Bridge crying, hey man, well this is Babylon. I've seen you fire up the gas in the engine valves. I've seen your hand turn saintly on the radio dial. I've seen the airwaves pull your eyes towards heaven. Outside Topeka in the phone lines, her good teeth smile was winding down. Engine sputters, ghosts out of gasoline fumes. They say you had it, but you sold it. You didn't want to know. I'm half drunk on babble. You transmit through your true dreams. True dreams.
Hi, this is Rogue Finch Radio. I'm your host, Patty Heffley, coming to you from the studios of Au Chateau Patrice in New York City. Rogue Finch Radio is a work in progress with lots and lots of variety. We will be here in one mutation or another, sometimes bringing you our own productions and other times productions by our friends from around the planet. You never know.
Not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on the rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Hahn, woman liberationist, and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
This is the first in a two-part series on the Black Revolutionary Movement. My guest today is Ashanti Alston. It is through knowing him I've learned what it means to be a real activist, and he is one of the most knowledgeable people I know about movement history. I am lucky to know him. So without any more introduction, here is the interview. I will present part two next week. The voices you will hear besides Ashanti and myself will be Police Commissioner and later Mayor of Philadelphia, Frank Rizzo. Mumia Abu-Jamal, former Black Panther and now on death row for being a revolutionary journalist and a victim of COINTELPRO, and Assata Shakur, former Black Panther in exile in Cuba. Today I'm sitting here in front of Ashanti Alston. He was a former member of the Black Panther Party and a former Black Liberation Army prisoner of war. I thought it was a good idea to talk to someone that has remained in the struggle for justice and equality for people most of his life. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became politicized.
All right. First, I'm from Plainfield, New Jersey. I was born in 1954. I came up through the 60s. So during 66, 67, there was a lot of rebellions in the United States, and my hometown in New Jersey happened to have been one of those towns that had a rebellion and had a major rebellion, even though it was not a major city. But even a little bit before that point, this was maybe 2 years before Malcolm X was killed. So I understood at the time something about Malcolm. I understood the civil rights movement. It was very big. And so the rebellion became a turning point for me. Seeing the troops come into the city, seeing the people in the Black community fight the troops off with weapons and actually hold certain territories until the National Guard and certain, I think it was the U.S. Army people came. It was a sight to see. It was very impressive. It had a deep impact on me, and from that point, it was me making a more conscious effort to understand what was going on in terms of Black people, struggle against racism, and within a year or so, I began to understand the concept of revolution.
What year was that?
The rebellion in Plainfield was 1967. You figure the Panther Party came into existence in 66. By 67, 68, I'm in junior high school, and we're young militants in the junior high school. By high school, we found out about the Black Panther Party, and so 69, 70, we were actively seeking out the Black Panther Party.
And was there one in Plainfield?
At the time, no. I mean, at least none that we knew of. But there was one in Newark, Jersey City, and a few other cities in New Jersey. And there was the major ones in New York. And we, as teenagers, we started traveling back and forth between Newark, Jersey City, New York, and our hometown, Plainfield, to meet Panthers and to find out what we could do.
Who were your influences?
Well, I say that there definitely was Panthers who influenced us. I would say before the Panthers, we were definitely influenced by people like Stokely Carmichael, H. Rapp Brown. We had heard about Robert Williams and what happened in the South with Robert Williams trying to do armed self-defense. But once we got involved with the Panthers, there was definitely certain Panthers more than others who we were influenced by. A lot of times when I say influence, I'm one person who I definitely have to mention, his slave name at the time was David Bryan. He's now known as Jihad Abdul-Mumit. He's now a prisoner of war in Lewisburg prison. He's been there total going on over 20 years, I think, and hopefully he'll be out soon. But there was people in the party. There was not leadership. They was definitely rank and file, and they were people we were influenced by because they were people who taught us on the street level how to be community workers for a specific revolutionary cause. They taught us how to sell the newspapers, how to relate to people, and a lot of it was based off of things we were learning from the Red Book. When Mao Zedong would talk about the three main rules of discipline and 8 points of attention, you know, what is our relationship to the people? We respect the people, we relate to the people, and things like that. So we had Panthers like Kimu, who was later killed as a Black Liberation Army soldier. We had there was a brother named Solomon from I think Solomon's from either Jersey City or somewhere in New Jersey. There was sisters in the party like Safia, who was known as Bernice Jones at the time, Safia Bukhari, Malika Adams, and others who were strong influences, worked with us every day. So we had, at this young age, as teenagers, we had good influences to teach us this new lifestyle, whether it was in relating to people on the streets, not being afraid to face, you know, the police in the community, or to understand that we were trying to build new relationships. Because people like Malika and Safi and others, these was Panther women. So we was getting an idea that these Panther women were different from other women, that they were not the submissive type, you know, so forth and so on. And we was learning things from the men, how to employ a lot of our already little street ways in a more political sense, in terms of instead of being combative with each other, you know, we must begin to turn that against our enemies and think about how we can protect our communities and educate our communities and actually serve our communities. They taught us what it meant to really be servants. And that was something in the party that was said so many times, it was almost drilled into you, that we were servants of the people, that we were here to raise the consciousness of the people, but to get the people to the point where they would use us and together we could move towards liberation, political power, total revolution.
Are some of these people still around, or what's become of them?
Some are still around, some are not, some are dead, some are in prison. There's like the New York Three, Noah, Jaleel, and Herman, they're still in prison. This is like year 26, 27. Well, there's others too. You got Seth Hayes, you have Veronza Bowers, who's out, I think, right now, and he might be in Florida, who's also been down over 20 years. And if I'm not in touch with any of them directly, indirectly, I hear about them. I find out how they're doing and things like that. I can't say that I've been doing as much as I think I can around them, but I never forget them.
As you said, you were a prisoner of war in the Black Liberation Army. Can you sort of talk a little bit about that philosophy of how you believe that it was a war?
One thing, you know, that, I mean, even before the Black Panther Party, I believed that it was going to take a fight for Black people to be free or for some really radical fundamental changes to happen in America. That was even the philosophy of H. Rap Brown, Stokely Carmichael, and others. What I learned in the Panther Party was to see revolution in a more scientific manner, how to approach it in a more organized manner, and to see that there were many more things to consider when one was seriously talking about doing whatever you really had to do to be free. When Malcolm said by any means necessary, it was really understanding what that meant in the Panther Party. So, in the Panther Party's philosophy, we could say, there's one point in the 10-point platform program that says that no member of the Black Panther Party can join any other army but the Black Liberation Army. For me, I accepted that and I believed that. So when it came time for me to make that move, I understood it. I believed in it. And even though it was a very big step for me, it was a very big decision for me, at some point I made the decision to join the Black Liberation Army. At the time, I was like 19. I was in a relationship with a sister who was pregnant. And so I had to really think about going underground. But what made me decide to go was not only the fact that I knew that a baby was coming on the way, and I really believe that it is time to fight for a better world for that child can come up, but that there was a sense of urgency and that I was approached to join the Black Liberation Army because there was a mission, an important mission to be done in freeing political prisoners. So it was something I had to really think about. And so in making that decision to go, I sacrificed, but I sacrificed believing that I'm doing the right thing, that we must keep this revolution going. This was, at this point, it's like 72, 73. And at this time, the movement is definitely on a decline. The newspapers are given this impression that they have broken the back of the movement, broken the back of the BLA, and you really feel like you must do something to counter that whole media assault, because it is easy for people to believe what the media says. So myself and others became a unit in the Black Liberation Army. From there, we began to engage in underground activities, and I mean without going into, you know, a lot of details, but we had a mission, and we went out to perform a certain mission and to do it as successfully as we could.
Was it true that they had broken the backs, or was that just propaganda?
No, they couldn't break the back. They never broke the back of the BLA. This was during the time that the BLA did suffer some setbacks in the sense that there was members who were captured, there were members who were killed, there were members who had to leave the country. Even some of those who left the country came back, you know, at will. But sometimes things got so hot that the best move was to just disappear for a while. But Twyman Myers, one of the, who I would call our finest revolutionary soldiers, was cornered on a certain street, I think in the Bronx, and he was shot down. I mean, he was shot down without a chance to even pull his gun out and fire back. And they shot him so bad that eyewitnesses says that one of his legs was just hanging by a tendon. But the newspaper accounts said that, oh, he fought back, he shot back, and so forth and so on. But we found out later that they never gave him a chance. But the newspapers also said this has broken the back of the BLA because they was really looking for Twyman. They wanted him from everything from bank robberies to kidnappings to bombings to ambushes, everything. Anytime something happened in the name of the BLA, they said Twyman was there. And every time they said they was close to catching him, you know, he would somehow miraculously get away. So there was also a certain myth developing around Twyman, all right, as this heroic guerrilla. And Twyman definitely was a heroic guerrilla, but their purpose was to convince, you know, the Black community and others that we got him. Once we got Twyman, that's it. We won't be hearing anything from the Black Liberation Army again. We put a lie to that. And I'm not just talking about the unit that I belonged to, but there was others out there who were still active, and there were still actions going on. So things did happen, but this is still at a point where, when I look back, I would say that there was still a steady decline in BLA activities, but in general, in the whole movement, not just the black movement, but most of the major movements in America at the time were on a decline, from the SDS, Dweather Underground, to the Native American movements and others. There was a decline. So there was internal problems going on. There was a vicious external attack from the COINTELPRO, and there was a definitely strong media assault. And one that you really couldn't understand at the time. I mean, I guess it really did have to take many years to pass for people to be able to look back and use some new analytical tools to say, man, they did some things to us that we really didn't understand. And I definitely think that the media manipulation of people's consciousness was extremely powerful.
That continues today, doesn't it, now?
Because of the violent actions of the leadership of the New Left, FBI officials concluded that some additional effort must be made to neutralize and disrupt this revolutionary movement.
The COINTELPRO program was a terroristic program. Its function was to terrorize radicals, revolutionaries, opponents of government programs, and to stigmatize and isolate them from the general population. They sent letters, smut letters, from husbands to wives. They sent letters to employers, stigmatizing people. They sent letters from one radical organization to another radical organization to try to incite violence between those two organizations. There were letters going between the organizations that were not authored by Panthers. They were authored by FBI agents in some dark office in California, to incite hatred and division between radical groups.
First of all, I think that the people are saying this are paranoid. You know, who is concerned with being shadowed or followed or wiretapped? Publicly, I give anyone permission to follow me, to tap my phones. So what are we hiding when we have this obsession that we're being followed? I think something's wrong with an individual that thinks this way. But running over people? No way. I just think that when you're involved in the game of politics, that you have friends and you have enemies, and survival of the fittest.
Now, let's talk about the race. We police, we obey the law. We go to a judge to get a search and seizure warrant, or warrants. Now we go to their locations. We announce that we are police, loudspeakers, etc. We knock. They don't open the door. They open fire on us. And three of my men are wounded. None of them injured. We had many of opportunity to kill them. But my police don't kill people in Clovevold. We leave it to the courts.
Running wild, bitter like bile, blood will guide their way. And I say, all we're doing is defending, so get you ready. The war, war.